John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, August 18th, 2010. Palestinians protest seizure of land for security zone in Gaza, and Israeli forces invade two West Bank towns. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. In the Gaza Strip, Palestinian farmers, along with international supporters, held a nonviolent demonstration protesting the creation of a security buffer zone on their farmland. The protest took place on the outskirts of the town of Beit Hanun in the northern Gaza Strip. As the marchers drew near to the nearly declared, quote, security buffer zone, end quote, 150 meters away from the border fence, Israeli soldiers began to fire toward them. No injuries were reported. Some demonstrators cut apart the rolls of barbed wire that had been placed by the Israeli military to mark the edge of the buffer zone. In the West Bank, Israeli forces attacked the East Jerusalem town of Abadis and the southern West Bank city of Hebron in two separate invasions Wednesday morning to search for men listed on the army's, quote, wanted, end quote, list. According to local sources, Israeli troops moved into the Palestinian town of Abadis and seized two Palestinian men from their homes in the early morning hours of Wednesday. In a separate invasion, Israeli troops moved into the town of Hebron in the southern West Bank and abducted one man from his home. Palestinians have long criticized the, quote, wanted, end quote, list used by the military to round up suspects, saying that informants are the main source of information for who gets on the list, and the informants are extremely unreliable and prone to corruption and revenge. Many Palestinians who are listed as, quote, wanted, end quote, have never had any affiliation with any armed group, but may have been listed by an informant because of a personal or family grudge. In other developments, for the third time in less than a month, Israeli occupation forces have handed house demolition orders to all the inhabitants of the village of Farsiya. Just under a month ago, the Israeli authorities demolished 120 buildings before returning 2 weeks ago to demolish another 6 Palestinian homes, as well as those that were built after the first round of demolitions. The Israeli military is facing criticism for their lackluster response to the posting of controversial photos by a former Israeli soldier on her Facebook page. The photos were posted by Aden Abergil and show her smiling, posing next to bound and blindfolded Palestinian men. The Facebook album was entitled, quote, "Israeli Defense Force, the best time of my life," end quote. Some Palestinians have compared the photos to those of U.S. soldiers posing in front of tortured prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. But the Israeli army says this comparison is unfair because, according to the spokesman, the prisoners in question were not tortured. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Dina Awad and Hassan Kassis.
The growing debate over building a mosque and community center near the site of the terrorist attacks at Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan has launched a multi-city bus ad campaign claiming to offer refuge to former Muslims. Bus ads questioning Islam are running in San Francisco, New York City, and Miami. The ads are sponsored by the group Stop Islamization of America, run by conservative blogger Pamela Geller. According to the Christian Science Monitor, her aim is to help ex-Muslims who get in trouble. Geller claims she started the campaign in response to a Florida teenage girl who ran away from her Muslim parents after converting to Christianity. Rifka Barry made headlines last year after she claimed her father threatened to kill her for becoming a Christian. Detroit, the city with the highest concentrations of Muslims in the U.S., refused to run the bus ads, and Geller sued the Detroit Transit Agency. She claims a controversial campaign sponsored by a group of atheists last year ran on buses and billboards in many cities and read, "Don't believe in God, you're not alone." Although offensive to some, the ads were deemed free speech. In Florida, the Miami-Dade Transit Agency initially pulled the ads, but reinstated them when threatened with a potential lawsuit.
That's the sound of a U.S. defeat in Iraq, soon to be repeated in Afghanistan the way things are going. Last night, the last elements of the 4th Striker Brigade slinked out of Iraq, driving their combat vehicles over the border into Kuwait. They were the last U.S. troops in Iraq designated as combat troops. About 50,000 combat-capable but non-combat-designated troops remain in Iraq and are required to leave by the end of next year. No insurgent group has left the country or thrown in a towel, and the U.S. has clearly been defeated on all but one of the original war objectives. Objective number one, overthrow Saddam Hussein. This objective was achieved by U.S. troops. Objective number two, defeat Al-Qaeda in Iraq. This group did not exist prior to the war and is still in Iraq, U.S. combat troops or not. Since Fallujah 2004, they have mounted attack after attack, continuing till this day. Therefore, the U.S. has been defeated on this war objective in Iraq. Objective number three, arrest Muqtada al-Sadr, stemming again from 2004, same time frame as the first Battle of Fallujah. Muqtada al-Sadr is out of U.S. reach in Iran, and his Mahdi army is unbeaten and unbowed. Therefore, Muqtada al-Sadr has won this war objective, and the U.S. has lost it. Objective number four, establish a stable government in Iraq. This is perhaps the biggest joke of all, with no government formed over 5 months since the last election. Since a number of rival factions have each defeated the U.S., but none have defeated their domestic rivals in elections nor in combat, civil war continues in Iraq. Nobody has won this objective. Not the U.S., certainly not the people of Iraq. Objective number five, obtain control over Iraqi oil. preferably with multinational oil companies allowed to own no oil fields. Total U.S. defeat. No faction in the previous Iraqi parliaments would agree to this, and no hydrocarbon law has been passed. Only minor technical service contracts have been allowed. The people of Iraq have won this war objective, defeating the U.S., Halliburton, and George W. Bush. Objective number six, establish a free market fundamentalist economic zone in Iraq as an example to be emulated by all other Middle Eastern nations. Utter and total U.S. defeat here, all the way back in 2004, maybe even 2003. As soon as Saddam fell and Iraqi Sunni workers were fired, they all took up arms and privatization ground to a halt. Nobody has even tried to convert the economy of Iraq into an American Enterprise Institute approved test case in years. Victory to the people of Iraq, crushing defeat to Cheney, the American Enterprise Institute, the World Bank, and the United States. The biggest strategic winner of all may be Iran, allied to Muqtada al-Sadr, allied with Karzai, and on the verge of war with both the U.S. and Israel. Meanwhile, the war is not over for the people of Iraq, and the fighting goes on. Baghdad, Iraq, Tuesday. A suicide bomber blew himself up among hundreds of Iraqi army recruits who had gathered near a military headquarters in an attack officials said killed 60 and wounded 125, one of the bloodiest bombings in months in the Iraqi capital. Iraq, today. Two civilians were wounded by a mortar round fired at the green zone that missed. America's friends in Iraq are doing especially poorly. Al-Anbar province, Iraq, today. A car bomb detonated at a police checkpoint, killing two cops and wounding three. Maiden, south of Baghdad, Iraq, today. An awakening militia checkpoint was shot up by unknown insurgents, killing one Sawa fighter and wounding two. The Sawa, or awakening fighters, are former insurgents who sided with the U.S. in 2007 and are regarded as traitors by many. Diyala province, Iraq. Today, another awakening fighter was killed by a sticky bomb attached to his car. His brother was wounded. Baghdad, Iraq. Yesterday, another generator exploded in eastern Baghdad, setting fire to stores and wounding 25 people, an Interior Ministry source reported. Again, a police source said the incident may have involved a bomb and that six people were killed. Again, a local resident claimed it was an accident and three people were killed. That's the second major generator explosion in a little over a week. Diyala province, Iraq. Three bodies of three farmers executed by unknown insurgents were found in Rabia. Leaflets warning against cooperation with both U.S. and Iraqi government forces were found on their bodies. They read, quote, "This is the future for all who cooperate with the U.S. military and Iraqi security forces." Can you say night letters? The storm of daily bombings and shootings still going on in Iraq is entirely too numerous to read them all out here. Meanwhile, the war in Afghanistan is still continuing down the exact same path as the war in Iraq. Afghanistan today. Eight NATO troops were injured when their helicopter made a hard landing. Was it shot down? The WikiLeaks papers report Taliban insurgents to be using portable heat-seeking missiles. Afghanistan, yesterday, the Washington Post is reporting that a U.S. soldier was killed in an IED attack. Afghanistan, yesterday, NATO is reporting one NATO soldier and four Afghan soldiers killed in an unspecified attack in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Tuesday, NATO is reporting the deaths of two American soldiers from an IED explosion in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Tuesday, NATO is reporting the death of another American soldier from an IED explosion in an undisclosed location in western Afghanistan. Afghanistan, yesterday, hundreds of protesters blocked the main road between Kabul and Jalalabad to protest the deaths of two people killed in a night raid on someone's home. The protesters said the two men killed were innocent civilians, while NATO claimed its forces killed two insurgents. Ghafur Khan, chief of Sirkrad district, said a father and his son were killed and three others were wounded in a Tuesday night operation. He said police were trying to control the crowd to keep the demonstration peaceful. Afghanistan, Monday. Six policemen were poisoned and then killed on Monday afternoon in Kandahar province by the Taliban, provincial officials reported. Kandahar police chief remarked that the policemen were killed after they ate poisoned food at iftar or fast breaking time in Don Prab district of Kandahar. The food was poisoned by their cook, and the cook has escaped with the Taliban, officials reported. Sounds just like Iraq, doesn't it? Mr. Barack Obama, the U.S. cannot win in Afghanistan with the same surge strategy that failed in Iraq. Now is the time to cut U.S. losses and throw in the towel. Bring all the troops home today.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has issued a decree ordering all private security firms to be disbanded by the end of the year. By that time, thousands of security contractors working in Afghanistan must join the Afghan police force or cease operations within 4 months. The one exception is for private security firms hired by international groups such as embassies or NGOs, which are required to remain within their compounds and be registered with the Interior Ministry. Karzai stated in his November 2009 inaugural speech that he would put an end to both foreign and domestic security companies by November 2011. The recent decree clearly expedites the deadline. The U.S. warned that such rapid withdrawal would be impossible to complete by the deadline and may slow down reconstruction and development. NATO commanders rely heavily on both foreign and Afghan security contractors to protect bases and convoys. According to the Associated Press, the U.S. claims the Afghan Interior Ministry currently licenses 52 security companies, a small fraction of the 30,000 security contractors working in the country. There have been an increasing number of complaints that private security firms, including Blackwater, aren't well regulated and operate in a manner that endangers the civilian population. Karzai spokesman Wahid Omar said, "It's not about regulating their activities. They have developed into alternative forces. The security companies have to go."
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
The 8th of August, anti-war protesters showed up at Quantico Marine Base demanding that Bradley Manning, the person accused of sending the documents to WikiLeaks that proved the U.S. is losing the Afghan war, be released, not prosecuted.
Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning! Free Bradley Manning!
My name is Matt. I served in Iraq in 2004. As an intel analyst, and as a former analyst, I stand with Bradley Manning today. Silence is betrayal.
That's right.
Silence is betrayal. The truth of these wars we all know, and some have seen. And Bradley Manning was courageous enough, brave enough, to stand against the military machine and release these things. Possibly. He's been accused, not convicted. If this is true, I admire his courage and strength.
Amen.
It is not criminal to tell the truth. It is not criminal to speak out against the military machine. It is criminal to stay silent in the face of something immoral, in the face of injustice. While there is injustice, there will never be peace. And it is unjust to jail someone for speaking the truth, for bringing to the American consciousness what we all know to be true, and that these wars are immoral, they're illegal, and they're unjust, and it's time to end them. It's time to bring our troops home. It's time to bring our soldiers home. Marines, Navy, everyone, bring them back. Stand with the Afghan people. Support the Afghan people. but not militarily. It's time to end these wars. I hope that we can all recognize that Bradley Manning is a hero and that he deserves to be freed and to be heard. Let his voice be heard, not the voices of many people for or against him, but let him tell his story, why he may or may not have done what he has done. So that's all I have to say.
All right. All right. Woo! Is our youth.
Bradley Manning is our youth. Give him power to speak the truth. Bradley.
Wars need secrets. Illegal wars keep illegal secrets. These aren't the only secrets. These are only secrets to people in this country. People in Afghanistan, they know this. People in Iraq, they know this. They don't need us to release documents telling them what's happening in their countries. The Taliban knows this, the people know this, the resistance forces, the anti-resistance forces. This isn't news. Ironically, the Obama administration is kind of trying to have it both ways. On the one hand, saying, there's nothing new here. Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But there's blood on their hands if they release it. Really? You want to really try and have it both ways?
Yep.
This is an illegal war. The secrets are illegal. Releasing secrets is the first step. This isn't just about Bradley Manning. This is about illegal wars with illegally held secrets. We should remember it was the Pentagon. It wasn't a whistleblower. It was the Pentagon who made their own decision about the decision to escalate in Afghanistan more than a year ago before President Obama announced it. They didn't seem to think that was inappropriate. We have a long history of whistleblowers in this country, and they have changed history. They come out of movements, and they strengthen movements. When Pentagon Papers 2.0 was released, what's known as the WikiLeaks documents, this absolutely reflected that history. It's a lie to say that we are protecting women. Keep in mind one thing. When those against our position who want to continue the war say, well, don't we have to stay to protect the women? Keep in mind one thing, that the vast majority of women who die too early in Afghanistan today don't die in a Taliban attack. They die in childbirth. Because Afghanistan is the second worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. One out of every six women in Afghanistan dies in childbirth. Now, in the year 2000, when the Taliban was in control, how many women do you think died in childbirth? Exactly the same. One out of six. We have done nothing for the women of Afghanistan except make their lives worse. That's the answer to those who say we need to maintain a military occupation. We need this information not because it's new, but because it's irrefutable. Because it's exactly what the president said. It was nothing new, but it changes how we understand these wars. That's why we need whistleblowers. That's why secrets kill. Wars need secrets. Democracy needs whistleblowers. Thank you.
Transparency is not a crime. War criminals do the crime. Transparency is not a crime. War criminals do the crime.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio@hushmail.com. WSQT Radio@hushmail.com.
Last August, protesters showed up at the Chilean embassy demanding freedom from Mapuche indigenous political prisoners who are on a hunger strike in Chile.
Solidarity vigil
to support the political prisoners in the south of Chile who are on hunger strike, and this is the 1 month anniversary, August 12th, began on July 12th. So these 31 men who are being held by the Chilean government under their so-called anti-terrorism law, they feel they are being held unfairly and they need to demonstrate and ask and to change policy further.
What are the Mapuche people supposed to be doing
now? I have they want that anti-terrorism law changed. Stop the implementation of the anti-terrorism law in all Mapuche cases. That was part of what happened under the Constitution with Pinochet, and they feel that it's very repressive and very harsh, and they want that lifted.
An old Pinochet-era law written with advice from the United States defines indigenous, that is to say Native American, resistance to land seizures and development as, quote, terrorism. Sound familiar?
You're saying he was shot in the back by the police in Chile?
Yes.
For what?
He was participating in an action, and he's trying to break it up.
And so they decided to rely on live ammunition. This protest is one of a worldwide sequence of simultaneous protests at Chilean embassies all over the world. The view from the embassy towards the street. Going double-sided, so all the yuppies going by their cars can see what this is about.
Towards the end of the vigil, protesters read out the names of the prisoners being held in Chile's dungeons.
Number 2, Luis Sergio Rangel Fidel.
Presente.
Number 3, Pablo Cano Tracal.
Presente.
Number 15, Luis Menares Sanilao.
Presente.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
On the 15th of August, as the Arizona Diamondbacks prepare to play at the National Stadium, formerly D.C.'s gay enclave, immigrant rights protesters showed up demanding that Major League Baseball move the All-Star Game out of Arizona. These protests have dogged the Diamondbacks ever since Arizona passed the racist SB 1070 immigration law, held unconstitutional in court, but still in appeals.
Willie in the name of...
When the game was played, the fifth inning, halfway through, was interrupted by protesters charging out of the field and a banner being dropped over the infield wall. Doesn't take much to stop a baseball game these days, and although four people were arrested and two barred from the stadium, according to one report, the mission was a success.
Okay, I'm here with Sara Uribe. You're an activist here in Washington, D.C. Tell me what happened today at this stadium.
Today we had a few brave people run into the field to send a message that the Diamondbacks cannot profit off of hate. They're here to send a clear message that the Arizona law, SB 1070, is a racist and immoral law, and it needs to be terminated in its full completion. So it was very exciting to see them in the middle of the stage, sending it to all of the people here, and sending a message that baseball needs to change, it needs to clean up its act, and it can start by protesting and continuing the boycott against the Diamondbacks and moving the game out of Arizona.
It was a very brief protest. I missed it, but I understand that police called these activists. How many people were involved?
There was one person who ran onto the stage, and then there were two other people who came out with a banner. Unfortunately, some security guards blocked them before they could unfurl the entire banner. They were wearing t-shirts that said legalize Arizona. And there was another banner drop that happened over here on this side of the stage, too. Again, it was somewhat interrupted by some of the other people. But I think the message came across.
Just in case it didn't, here's what things sounded like at the protest outside the stadium that most people going into the game had to pass on the way in.
Don't give in to racist fear!
Immigrants, I welcome you!
Don't give in to racist fear!
Immigrants, I welcome you!
Arizona, you control! Racist laws have got to go!
There were over 50 protesters demanding that Major League Baseball comply with the economic and cultural boycott of Arizona by moving the All-Star Game to somewhere else. And there were no more than 10 of the right-wing Minute Clan Nazi types counter-protesting. They were heavily outnumbered.
No racist laws have got to go! Arizona, you can grow racist laws!
That's an interesting chant. Arizona, new Jim Crow, racist laws have got to go.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that
Arizona's SB 1070, that had it not been struck down in court, would have allowed cops to stop people and demand immigration papers, is very much like the past laws that were applied to African Americans in a time of slavery, and is very much in the spirit of Jim Crow. Now, some people might point to majority support among Americans elsewhere for Arizona-type legislation, but remember, Jim Crow also had majority support, at least among white voters it did, that is.
Hey, baseball! Let's face it! Arizona is racist!
There's another ugly little backstory to anything happening at the National Stadium. That is that the National Stadium, just like Arizona, is stolen land. Arizona was stolen by force by the United States from Mexico, which had in turn stolen it by force from indigenous people. Well, D.C.'s baseball stadium sits on land stolen by force from D.C.'s gay community, where an entire neighborhood was bulldozed to make way for Major League Baseball.
Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses. Some of those that work forces are the same that burn crosses.
Well, DNA, it's natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depending on another, and so the circle, it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows, they grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
Although crude oil stopped gushing from British Petroleum's blown-out Deepwater Horizon oil well after a custom metal cap was finally lowered on top of the damaged wellhead a mile under the Gulf of Mexico on July 15th, a permanent fix has still not been carried out. Government officials say further pressure tests and risk assessment will be necessary before the well is permanently killed through the injection of mud and concrete via a relief well. During the 86 days of the BP spill, some 4.9 million barrels of oil poured into the Gulf of Mexico in the nation's worst environmental disaster. A report released by Georgia's Sea Grant College program and the University of Georgia concludes that up to 79% of the oil released into the Gulf of Mexico has not been recovered and remains a threat to the ecosystem, contradicting a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration report that claimed only 25% of the oil remained in the Gulf. Apart from billions of dollars lost in regional tourism and the seafood industry, the long-term effects of the oil and chemical dispersant on human and marine life are unknown. Hugh Kaufman, senior policy analyst at the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, blew the whistle on EPA and OSHA's cover-up of the environmental health effects on first responders at the World Trade Center site in New York City after the 9/11 attacks. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hugh Kaufman, who explains why he believes that the EPA is now involved in a similar cover-up of the hazards present in the BP oil spill.
Well, I mean, my perception is, unfortunately, that the response to this has been similar to the 9/11 case, where they tried to, both BP and the government, downplay the impact of this. And frankly, there were a lot of false statements being made and continue to be made about how much oil and contaminated material is even left. I mean, you've heard some of the press statements that only 25% is left. Yet when you look deeper into the statistics, you find that even the scientists whose statistics they use think there's more like 75% of the oil and contaminants still down there.
Hugh Kaufman, I've read a quote that you felt that the Environmental Protection Agency that you work with and the National Oceanic and Atmosphere Administration, NOAA, were really sock puppets for British Petroleum in covering up the toxicity of this oil dispersant called Corexit. You want to explain to our listeners a little bit about what you meant there?
Well, sure. I mean, the problem that was, it was not just me, I just happened to be a whistleblower, whereas other people in the system are a little bit more nervous. I'm almost 70 years old, so I can retire down the line. But most of the technical people inside are very disappointed that EPA and NOAA, in fact, has been doing what's in the best interest of BP in terms of these toxic dispersants, as opposed to what's in the best interest of the environment and the public. Now, let me explain. These are hazardous materials that were being pumped into the water at a mile down, as well as being carpet bombed over the area to try to make the oil disappear under the surface. By doing that, you're increasing the toxic reaction to the oil that's being atomized into droplets by the dispersants, as well as increasing toxicity with the dispersant oil mix. That will have a very adverse effect on marine life underneath the surface, but will make it look on the surface like there's in fact less oil, And that's what BP wanted. BP wanted the optics of less oil on the surface so that they could try to hide the volume of oil that has, in fact, gushered up, which will save them billions of dollars in fines and penalties. And we'll make it almost impossible to clean up the area in a timely fashion. Let me explain. In the case of the Amoco Cadiz oil spill, which was a very big spill back in 1978 off the coast of France, some of that oil was dispersed and some of it was allowed to be broken up, weathered, if you will, by natural forces. The oil that was not dispersed with dispersants started breaking up, and it's pretty much all been resolved within 5 years back in the 80s. But the oil where dispersants were used to atomize the oil, that oil has still not been eaten by the microbes. And so to this day, over 30 years later, that oil is still presenting a problem in that area that the oil spill occurred. So you're going to have the same problem in the Gulf of Mexico because they use so many dispersants down there. It's going to take a lot longer for that oil to be broken down by natural processes as opposed to if they hadn't used the dispersants.
Hugh, what about the seafood industry in the Gulf of Mexico? I know there's a lot of testing we hear about now of the seafood stocks and to see what's safe and how soon the fishermen can get back into making a living off their trade. They're catching shrimp and other fish that they sell across the country. What's your understanding of the situation there right now?
Well, first of all, there's been so much misinformation put out there about the seafood being safe, and that, for example, just the other day I heard government people making the statement that they haven't found any contaminated fish. Nobody buys that, certainly not even the fishermen buy that. In sworn testimony to Congress that there's no dispersants in the fish that they've tested. And then with a follow-up question for a United States senator, they have to admit, no, we haven't tested the fish for dispersants. So until such time as the government can get more realistic and be honest with the people, I think the public is not going to believe anything that the government says, and the fishermen don't believe it either. In fact, evidence comes up all the time that there is serious contamination in the water, and there's a lot of fish in the water, and no one believes that fish can swim and breathe in that contamination and not be contaminated. Certainly, experienced doctors in the field don't believe it. Neither do most marine biologists.
That was Hugh Kaufman, Senior Policy Analyst with the Environmental Protection Agency. He was Chief Investigator on many contamination cases, including Love Canal and Times Beach, and was the originator of EPA's Toxic Cleanup Superfund program.
Is your SUV running low on gas? Has your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown-out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway. Last winter, climate change skeptics tried to claim the blizzard as evidence against global warming. Now the hottest summer in living memory has come not only to D.C., but to many places all over the planet. Russia is plagued by heat waves, drought, and massive wildfires, making the air around Moscow almost unbreathable. Here in the D.C. area, we never used to have weather conditions so extreme. Pepco dropped the ball 3, even 4 times in 1 year, with power outages lasting for days, even a week for some people. Now we've had a blizzard of snowstorms in the winter and a blizzard of super thunderstorms in the summer, both leading to extended power outages. Yesterday's morning storm was a typical example. It dropped 1.5 inches of rain, closed streets, dropped trees on houses, and made Rock Creek look like Great Falls. Still convinced our climate isn't changing? Still convinced all that mountaintop removal coal being burned at Pepco's suppliers of electricity isn't literally turning itself off with its own carbon dioxide-driven weather? It seems to me that we're coming to a real turning point on global climate change. Scientists have warned about this for the last decade, but with the failure of one climate conference after another, from Kyoto to Copenhagen, it just seems to me that nobody has been listening.
Federal District Court Judge Vaughn Walker's August 4th decision, which declared California's Proposition 8 banning gay marriage unconstitutional, has revived an emotional nationwide debate on the future of gay marriage across the country. Proposition 8 passed by a 52-48% margin in a November 2008 California statewide ballot, outlaws gay marriage by amending the state constitution, overturning a May 2008 California Supreme Court ruling that found same-sex couples have a right to marry. In his August 4th ruling overturning Proposition 8, Judge Walker wrote, "Proposition 8 fails to advance any rational basis in singling out gay men and lesbians for denial of a marriage license. Indeed, the evidence shows Proposition 8 does nothing more than enshrine in the California Constitution the notion that opposite-sex couples are superior to same-sex couples." The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit extended a stay on Judge Walker's ruling, which means marriage licenses will not be issued to California's gay couples until after the appeals court itself rules on the constitutionality of Proposition 8. Most observers believe the case will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Carol Scagnetti, board president of the group Marriage Equality USA, who reacts to the recent court decisions and the uncertainty over the future of gay marriage.
You know, from a human perspective, my reaction to Judge Walker's decision was, I was pretty elated. You know, we've been through so many decisions in the past 5 years, court decisions, elected officials' decisions, and so forth, that, you know, I've almost become sometimes a little bit desensitized to whether the decision is for us or against us, because we know that there'll still be more work to do. But Judge Walker's decision was particularly important because, number one, there was evidence produced at this trial, mountains of evidence from people, from experts, from gay folks, from supporters, mayor of San Diego. Many people really established the fact that there's really no difference. Marriage is marriage between two people who are committed. And it also established the fact that this Proposition 8 and all the other anti-LGBT marriage initiatives and ballot measures across the country are really established because a group of people don't like it, and they're angry, and they have some animus toward gay people based on old stereotypes and prejudices. That became so evident that this decision was, to my thinking and to my feelings, very, very important, because anyone who reads this decision sees how carefully he lays out all of these facts and all of these arguments and essentially pulls the rug out from under each and every argument.
You know, one of the things that people have been talking about since David Boies and Ted Olson brought this case. Was that, in your mind, is there some uncalculatable risk here that the Supreme Court, a fairly conservative Supreme Court, could eventually rule against gay marriage and allow these state referendums and other initiatives to ban gay marriage state to state stand? Is this something that concerns you, that this could be a coin toss of some type that could set back the movement for gay marriage by decades?
Well, yeah, you said it perfectly. It is an incalculable risk. We can not predict what the Supreme Court will do, but nor can the other side. And I think they are as much at risk, and realizing that they are as much at risk right now as we are. We don't know how one or two people on the court will decide, and we can't predict that. And it is, but for years people have said, go slowly, it's too scary, we don't know what will happen. But, you know, at some point you have to say, all right, we're jumping into the pool. So I think that there is reluctance. I think there's concern and fear, and it has been an incremental step-by-step movement for so many years that the decision of when is the big step, the right time, is one that's discussed at length all over blogs and so forth. And there, I don't think there's a right answer, but when you have two of the most prominent, both, you know, Democratic and Republican attorneys in the country bringing this case, I think it says somebody thinks it's time.
So you have confidence in David Boies and Ted Olson, who initiated this case, and if all things work out as they hope, they'll be arguing this case in front of the Supreme Court.
I think, as they hope, they will be, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. There's pros and cons to how this case to come out. From a selfish standpoint, you know, maybe we say, wouldn't it be nice if there was a very narrow ruling and we just got marriage back in California and there would be another state that has legal marriage and another step closer to winning in the Supreme Court. That's one view. It's a feeling of safety and a better feeling than taking a huge risk.
What do you make of the argument of proponents of Proposition 8, that Judge Walker's decision overturned the will of the people, that somehow that's sacrosanct and should not be messed with by the judiciary branch of government, that this particular referendum, which won, should be honored. What's your view on that?
You know, I think the populace doesn't get to vote on who has access to fundamental rights. And, you know, that's a fundamental principle of our country's government and of our Constitution. We don't put rights up to a vote, I think, as Ted Olson said on CNN. I mean, would we put free speech up to a vote? What if we passed a law? What if 52% of the people in California passed a law that no one could have a gun in this state, including a hunting firearm? I think there'd be a huge outcry from some of the same people who have an outcry about our rights being decided by a judge.
That was Carol Scagnetti, board president of the group Marriage Equality USA. Contact the group by calling area code 510-496-2700 or visit their website at marriageequality.org.